Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist, and you can find us online at speculist.com. That's speculist.com. Or you can go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. And the website, and on this program, we talk about the future, and we take a slightly different spin on the future than you're likely to get in a lot of other places. We try to give you the straight scoop about what's happening in the world and what we think is going to be happening in the world. And the straight scoop is that our world is not, as many will tell you, going to hell in a handbasket or by any other means, but in fact getting better all the time. And not only is the world getting better, but we believe that we stand on the brink of an incredibly bright future, if we play our cards right, a future that most of us haven't even imagined, much less dared to hope for. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me, as always, in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hi, Phil. How are you?
Well, I'm just very excited about the program that we've got going on tonight. This is going to be a fun one.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we've...
How about you?
Oh, yeah. I'm doing great. Before we get to our guest tonight, we've been talking movies, seems like, every week. It's the summer season, I guess, right?
So. Yeah, a lot of movies coming out, and I saw you published you posted some Hulk, not quite spoilers, but preview type information on.
Well, that's one I'm looking forward to. I hadn't seen yet, but someone had. But actually, the one I took the kids to and had a great time. If you got kids, load them up and take them to Kung Fu Panda. It's hilarious.
Oh, really? Okay.
It was very fun. Jack Black was as funny as he always is, and. Yeah, there was a great supporting cast. Of course, it's animated, but I mean, it was a great, fun movie, and the kids had a great time.
Sounds like fun. I've seen the previews for that. It looks funny. I'm not sure if I have an excuse to go see that because my daughter's 19.
Yeah. If you just show up without a kid in tow, you might feel a little out of place.
I think she's going to take for Father's Day. Going to take me to see The Incredible Hulk next week. So I'm. Very excited about that. We've also got on the line Michael Darling. How are you, Michael?
Good evening. I'm good.
Good. Seen any exciting movies? How's the baseball thing going? We've been meaning to check in with you on that.
Baseball is just now really in transition mode. We're ending, and that's why I'm a little spacey this afternoon. We had a game yesterday and a game today, and I celebrated this afternoon with a beer in the middle of the afternoon, which I never do anymore. So I'm, feels like it's middle of the night for me.
Now, none of the players had any beer. I think it's important to make sure that...
It's correct. They're and they weren't around when this happened. I had left the field. I had packed away all the equipment, and I said, I think I'm going to have a beer instead of cutting the lawn.
Well, that's always a good choice. I think you chose wisely there. So how are they doing generally? They were off to kind of a rough start. How are they wrapping up their season?
Let's say it this way. We started off with our three priorities for the season. Nobody gets hurt. Everybody has fun. Everybody gets better at every practice and every game. And we definitely nailed the first two, and we're pretty close on the third.
Okay.
That's good enough. Yeah.
You know, as long as you've got your criteria for success well established and you're working towards those goals, plus these kids are how old again? Six, 7 years old?
Eight. Eight and
eight
seven.
8 years old.
Yeah. Seven and eight.
Yeah. For most of these kids, it's their first exposure to organized baseball, and so it was a steep learning curve.
Right. Well, and plenty of time to stress out over ERAs and batting averages and strikeouts and all those kinds of things, I would guess.
We'll do that later.
In later years, yeah, absolutely.
Yep.
Okay, well, we're going to send you off into the chat room as we bring out our guest, and Michael will be checking in with us a little bit later with commentary and questions for our guest, and let's bring him out now. Tonight on the program, we're very pleased to welcome Rand Simberg, who self-describes as a recovering aerospace engineer and a consultant in space commercialization, space tourism, and internet security. He offers, again, self-described, occasionally biting commentary about Infinity and Beyond at his weblog, Transterrestrial Musings. You also see him on Pajamas Media from time to time, and it seems like he shows up in other venues as well. I would only correct him on the occasionally. I think it is frequently, if not consistently, biting commentary. But, Rand, we're very delighted to have you. Welcome to Fast Forward Radio.
Well, thanks. Glad to be here.
So I thought we've got so many different topics that we'd like to get into this evening because there's just a lot of space stuff that we kind of talk around the edges on the show, and we have not had a Stephen, is this correct? We've not had a dedicated space show since we've been doing it weekly. Is that right?
I think that's right. Before we went weekly, we had one of our monthly shows that was like probably a couple of years ago. Phil, we spent on space, but yeah, we've not had an opportunity to have somebody who's worked in aerospace to be on the show with us to visit about it. This gives us the opportunity to really
absolutely
ask these questions. You know,
we're way behind. We got a lot of catching up to do. So, Rand, I'm going to start right off with I'm having some trouble with my DirecTV. Okay, I turned it on this afternoon, and I wasn't getting any of the actual program information. And my wife was very upset, and I said, don't worry, I'm talking to a space guy a little bit later. This is a satellite thing, I'm sure. So.
Well, you know, this is funny, because I had a problem with my DirecTV this morning. It was working great last night. We watched Contact, and then we watched Coal Miner's Daughter. We went to bed, we woke up in the morning, and there was no signal. No
sunspots or something.
No, it was, I don't know what it was, but I went out, I looked at the dish. This looked fine. It looked like it was pointing kind of generally the right direction. It's hard to imagine. We had no wind. We had no nothing, no rain, no weather. I got out my little handy-dandy signal meter. I stuck it in the flow, and it worked fine. And my better half came out and said, hey, you just fixed it, just because I stuck this other thing in the middle of it. And then I put them back together, so I just figured it was just like a bad connection or something. I took it apart, put it back together. It worked. So anyway, I don't know what you were going to ask me.
That was my fun intro. But see, how cool that we get an actual DirecTV story from you where you fixed your satellite dish. I was going to suggest that maybe you had some kind of uplink and you just repointed the satellite slightly so that your service would be improved. But
that's tough.
Yeah, that requires some hacking, I would think, probably to get that level. But.
Hacking is a minor word for what that would require.
Yeah. But what I was going to say was, since the phrase I used to introduce you there, space guy, is a little broad, why don't you take us through kind of some of the highlights of the Rand Simberg story from your days as a aerospace engineer to the stuff you're doing now?
I grew up in space. Watched the space program in the 60s. Watched people walk on the moon. Got all excited about space. Got very depressed about space after Apollo died. Went to college. Was doing other stuff. Heard about Jerry O'Neill and space colonies. Said, "Hey, this makes sense. There actually is a way forward. It could actually, pay for itself." Got back into space. Graduated with a degree. Went into the aerospace industry. Realized very quickly that the aerospace industry was not getting us into space, but did it for a while because it was decent money, not great money, but decent living. Tried to figure out that the way to get into space was private stuff. So after a little over decade and a half of being a space professional, aerospace project manager, that kind of stuff, quit and tried to be an entrepreneur. Lost a lot of money at it, but still believes in it, and still working at it.
Okay, so that's the longer version. And maybe as a kind of a sideline to that, how did you get interested in blogging about space, and how did you get started doing that?
I never got interested in blogging about space. Oh. I got interested in blogging.
Just blogging generally in space.
I got interested in blogging because, I was... just not long before 9/11, really late August 2001, a mutual friend of ours said, "Hey, look what Glenn Reynolds is doing," because I'd known Glenn back from the 80s and the 90s when we were doing space stuff, because he was people don't realize this, but he was the head of the executive committee for the National Space Society.
Right.
And so I'd known Glenn for a long time, and so when he started Instapundit, you know, other people who knew Glenn, and in fact I'd even been on a mailing list with him and other people, you know, so we were kind of exchanging jibes, you know, like in the late 90s and stuff online. So when Glenn started doing this, I said, I didn't really say this. I didn't say that if Glenn can do it, anybody can, because obviously Glenn has some very unique traits that make him a great, great, great blogger. But I did say, you know, if Glenn can do this, I can do this. I can't get his readership, but you know, here's a way to give the world my opinion, to which I think everybody is entitled. And
right, absolutely.
Yeah, and that's what blogging is all about, right? So I looked up the software, and I started up a blog in October. It wasn't about space. It was just, hey, here's a way for me to, you know, bypass the gatekeepers and, you know, not have all these letters to the editor rejected, because that's really what blogs are, right? It's a letter to the editor. Except you don't have to hope that the editor will read it and decide to run it and not, you know, edit the hell out of it. So I started up this blog, but obviously because of my interests, I also blogged about space. So I became known at least partially as a space blogger. The other part is that I'm a right-wing nut. you know, for whatever that's worth. You know, I don't accept that, obviously, but that's the way a lot of people who read me for the space stuff characterize me, because they don't agree with my politics, which are not right wing in my opinion. But you know, that's an opinion. It's all obviously very subjective.
Well,
but,
you know.
But anyway, the point is, I am not a space blog. If you read my blog, there's a lot of space stuff there, but there's probably even more non-space stuff there.
That's true, and you know, I read your blog across the board, but I guess I guess it's the graphic at the top that makes me think of it as a space blog.
Well, but the other funny thing is the name. See, it's transterrestrial. It's not extraterrestrial. Transterrestrial musings.
There you go.
Across the planet, not away from the planet, not off the planet. It's, you know, it's just. I'm thinking about everything.
There you go. So what would you say is the breakdown? How much of what you do is on space, and how much is on politics or other subjects?
Oh, gee, I don't know. It kind of depends. You know, if something spacey is going on, you know, obviously when Columbia had its event,
yeah,
I was blogging about space pretty much, you know, 24/7.
Right.
But other than that, no, basically my blog is about whatever is going across my mind at the moment, and there's a lot of important issues going on in the world.
Yeah.
So I don't know how to answer that question. I haven't, you know, tried to do a statistical analysis on my posts.
Yeah.
So it's...
we haven't done that either as a speculist, although we have the editorial policy that we don't allow ourselves to get into politics or religion on the speculative, so we kind of...
I have no problem with that.
Yeah, no,
I blog on whatever. The whole point of my blog is, you know, all my life I've never had a diary.
Right.
But it actually has acted, you know, as a diary for the last few years. And I guess maybe it never occurred to me before until this very night, so this is like a scoop. But I never had a diary because I figured, well, I'll write this thing in this diary, and who's going to care? But I've got this blog now. As long as I keep the server up or whatever, or Google remembers, you know, there's actually a record. So I'm more motivated to kind of write stuff. But on the other hand, it is not a really personal blog. You know, I don't say what I had for breakfast this morning. I don't say, you know, the cat threw up, you know.
Yeah, I haven't seen a lot of cat blogging on transterrestrial.
Yeah. Well, I do cat blog occasionally, but it's only when the cat does something significant.
And, yeah, not,
you know,
not like
cat,
a daily.
The cat throws up
cat
a couple times a week.
Yeah.
It's not like I'm going to blog that. You
know? Exactly. Now, I would. The last thing I would do is talk about what we do at the Speculist by way of, you know, telling other people what I think they ought to do on their blogs. But I have found that keeps me from getting sucked into it, right? Yeah, if we started doing politics, it's like it turns into a political blog, or if we allowed religious discussions, I fear it would turn into a religious blog. And this way we get to stay on the subjects that we've chosen. Plus, there's, you know, there's lots of other venues where that stuff
gets done. And I probably have got sucked into that more than I should because of all the people that call me. You know, I had a somebody in comments over at Clark Lindsay's Space Transport News site, you know, said, gee, I really like all the stuff that Simbert did, you know, trying to develop zero-G back in the 90s, which half of which he got wrong, but he's a right-wing nut job.
Oh, there you go. So even your space comments don't matter because of politics.
Yeah, right, because I'm a right-wing nut job. Because I don't just comment about space. I comment about everything I think, and,
right.
You know, then it gets filtered through the prism of, you know, whatever morons read it, and, you know, so I'm a right-wing nut job, even though I'm not right-wing and I'm not, as far as I know, a nut job.
Well, there you go. And I think, to me, that's kind of the downside, actually, is what happens in the comments. I was just writing over at Michael Anisimov's blog the other day, because he had written a blog post that touched tangentially on religion, and, you know, it turned into this thing, and there were like 70 comments in the the comment section of the blog, and I'm reading through these, and, you know, it just starts going in these very predictable directions with, you know, people eventually calling each other Stalinists or Nazis or, you know, whatever.
Fascists. That's
yeah, fascists. Yeah, exactly. You know,
not there's anything wrong with
whatever.
That.
Exactly. Yeah. So
because I've read Jonah's book, you know, there's anything wrong with fascists, but.
But anyway, throwing the names around, and I said to him, I said, Michael, you know, I always bemoan the fact, I'm always telling Stephen this, that it seems like we never get the big long comment threads, and it drives me crazy until I start reading these big long comment threads, and then I really don't mind.
Say, gee, I'm glad I don't get these really long comment threads, right?
Yeah, because they just seem to go in this particular direction.
The other point about religion is that. I can't avoid talking about religion because, well, I'm by conventional terms, I'm irreligious. But on the other hand, I've got a whole separate website that has a ceremony to celebrate, you know, July 20th, and it's set up like a seder. So I'm not a non-religious person. It's just I've got a bizarre religion.
Okay.
Let's get to that in just a moment. I just want to say you're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. We're talking with Rand Simberg about space and about blogging. And if you'd like to join the conversation, you can join us in our chat room, or you can give us a call at 347-215-8972. Now, the religion is around the High Holy Day is July 20th. Is that correct?
Currently. I mean, there may, you know, if it evolves and we actually develop it more, there may be some other higher day. But that seems to be a pretty significant day. I mean, you know, because the whole, as the ceremony says, at evoleterra.com, evoleterra.com, this was, and you know, we have a quote there from Arthur Clarke. This was probably the most significant event since, you know, the first life. Crawled onto the land from the sea because it was life moving out. And because basically if I have a religion, it is that, you know, life persists, life will fill the universe, and life will not just fill the universe with mindless life, but life will fill the universe with conscious life, and life will help the universe to come to know itself. And that's one of the things that was great about Arthur Clarke. I mean, I think he believed that too. I mean, he was.
Well, it's a great reminder, and I link to your Evoleterra site every July 20th.
Yeah, because it's coming up. It hadn't occurred to me, but it's, you know, time flies.
You haven't done any of your shopping probably yet. Yeah.
So, yeah.
Evoleterra cards.
Yeah, you know, 40 shopping days till July 20th.
You know what I like about a religion started by an engineer, though, I have to say. As I say, so your high holy day is X, and he goes, well, so far.
well, because...
I think that's great, you know.
Because we're still trying
to...
It's still evolving, I mean...
Yeah,
because it's an evolution. This is a religion that believes... In fact, I got into a kind of little dispute with somebody who said, I really love this ceremony. I'm going to change these few words in it that says, you know, God made this happen. And I said, no, I'm not going to grant you... copyright. That's going to be a copyright violation. If you want to reprint our ceremony that say, no, you know, this was about God, no. I'm not denying God, but I'm saying that, you know, the focus of this ceremony is about science. It's about, you know, what humankind has achieved through reason and science. And when you refuse to say that these things evolved, when you want to change, you love the ceremony, you say, oh, that's great, I like about going to the moon and all that stuff, but I don't accept that life evolved, you've kind of missed the point of the whole ceremony.
So ultimately, is it fair to say that you've got a doctrine and you're not going to tolerate deviation from the doctrine?
No, we will not. Well, I'm not going to chop their heads off, but I am. Yes, we are not going to allow our copyright to be violated, and take the ceremony and sully it for a different purpose.
Now, there's another holiday. I don't know if it's on the official calendar of the Evola Terra holy days, but one that we celebrated back in April, Yuri's Night, which is the kind of a similar recognition of a big deal, right?
First
man in space. And we got to talking, the show we did the night after that anniversary, we got to talking about how that event is tied into a number of other events that are of significance in terms of our kind of rollout into space. And when Phoenix landed, 2 weeks ago, that was actually on the anniversary of President Kennedy making his landmark presentation to a joint session of Congress talking
right.
about we need to go to the moon.
I had a Pajamas Media piece about that, in fact.
Yeah, and that, you know, as Stephen pointed out as we were talking about that, those two events were not unconnected, right? There's a major response on our part to what the Russians were doing and the fact that that he made that announcement. What I'd like to do is talk a little bit about plans to go to the moon then versus plans to go to the moon now, and see what we make of the where we were then and where we are now. And maybe, Stephen, just by way of setting that up, let's remember what we were hearing back at that time.
We choose to go to the moon. 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 We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. We choose to go to the moon.
Okay, we got him in a little problem there. I can't even get it.
He was a talented man.
That goal of our energy will serve to organize and that challenge of our energy.
Wow. Sorry about that.
Let me say that...
Dueling Kennedys.
Doing things because they're hard is one of the stupidest reasons to do something.
Okay. Well, I mean, it was... I guess you could argue that we did it because it was possible.
We did it because it was hard, because we did it because we were trying to beat the Soviets. We were in a Cold War.
Yeah.
It did not advance us in space. And in fact, in many ways, it set us back for half a century, because we chose a goal for a stupid reason, and because we chose it for a stupid reason, we chose a stupid way to do it in terms of actually advancing us in space and making us a spacefaring civilization and making things happen. And we also established a mindset, and that's what we have to somehow get past. And NASA has not done it, because now they're just doing Apollo on steroids.
When you say it was a goal chosen for a stupid reason, was it a bad goal? Was it a bad thing to try to go to the moon at that time? Or
it was a great thing. It was a great thing from the standpoint of winning the Cold War. It was a horrible, horrible thing from the standpoint of getting us into space. you do not, I mean, if you think that the highest, you know, how hard something is a value, okay, let's dig a hole at China. That's pretty tough. Let's set that as a national goal. Right?
Right.
Right. Okay.
So that it's a stupid, stupid reason to do something, except in the context of it was a way to demonstrate our technological superiority. Okay? But that demonstrating your technological superiority is not the most productive way to open up the space frontier.
Well, Rand, I'm following you to the, you know, I agree that the reason for Apollo was to demonstrate our technological superiority. But how did that set us back instead of push us forward?
It set us back because we did it in a way, we poured 4% of the federal budget into that project because it was important. It wasn't important because space was important. It wasn't important because going to the moon was important. It was important because we had been shocked by the Russians and Sputnik, and we had to demonstrate that we were better than they were at space, because space at that time was a very scary thing. You know, Johnson said, we are not going to go to bed by the light of a communist moon,
right.
I should say.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's some English dialect where moon is pronounced as mune, but...
No, we followed you. We know what you meant.
Apollo was not about getting us into space. Apollo was about beating the commies. Because of that, we've identified that as the way to do space, and that has been exemplified by the current, you know, attitude of NASA, which is, okay, we're not just going to do Apollo, we're going to do Apollo on steroids.
Right. So then and now, so compare the Apollo program as originally conceived and executed versus the program that's planned now for going to the moon. What would you say are the big similarities and what are the big differences? It sounds like philosophically very similar.
Well, technically very similar.
Mm-hmm.
The biggest big problem is back then getting to the moon was important. Now it's not. But NASA's acting as though it is, and they're going to get the budget for it to do it the way they did it before. Not going to happen.
Okay, because it'll be abandoned. Is that what you're?
Yes, because for this exactly the same reasons as Apollo was abandoned. Because once they'd achieved the goal, everybody said, "Okay, been there, done that. Cost a lot of money. Not going to do it anymore." Well, the way NASA's doing it now costs a lot of money, and money that we don't have.
So should we just let nature take its course? In other words, get to the moon or get into space because we have commercial reasons to go there? What should take us back to the moon? What's the proper motivation?
Good question. The proper motivation is we should go back to the moon because there are resources there that we can learn to use how to learn in space, but that backs you up one step that says, why do we even want to be in space? And that's
right.
Something that we really haven't had a useful national discussion on since 50, you know, late 50s, early 60s.
Were we saying we wanted to be in space for at that time?
At that time there was a bunch of stuff because we were kind of, you know, technically and politically naive that said we want to be in space because the ability to be in space just demonstrates, you know, technical superiority, and there was this big ideological war going on between I'm not going to say capitalism, socialism. It was really a war between democracy and totalitarianism.
Okay.
Because if we'd had a capitalistic space program, it would have looked nothing like what happened with Apollo. Right.
Right.
Our
top-down program for sure.
Yeah, it was our socialist state space enterprise against their socialist state space enterprise. But ours was democratic, And part of the reason for that was we were trying to keep Europe on board, because they Europe was not into the capitalism then or now, right? The first order.
Yeah.
So that was the reason. But that was really what drove the space program in the 1960s. And I actually had a post two or three weeks ago that said, I've long said NASA is kind of a socialist space program, but I was wrong. It's a fascist space program. Not that there's anything wrong with that.
Hold that thought.
This is Fast Radio
on the Blog Talk Radio Network. We're talking with Rand Simberg. If you'd like to join us, you can call us at 347-215-8972 or join us in the chat room. Okay, so NASA is a fascist space program? Is that what I understood you to say?
Yes, that's what I said. Because and if you read, Goldberg's book, on the lost history of the progressive movement, really, that's what it is, in the 20th century, you can recognize all the elements of fascism in the way we set up NASA. Because, we were in a war, and that's a good way to win a war, is to set up this situation where you have, a unity of purpose in the country, and everybody's behind it, and we have our representatives, and I mean, the only thing that's missing that I haven't found yet, but I'm pretty sure I will, which I have seen in the Obama campaign, by the way, are the kind of the Soviet realist, surrealist, posters of, change and hope and that kind of thing.
Rand, I wanted to ask you, as far as space goes, are you more excited now to see, commercial ventures like Spaceship One versus, NASA continuing to dominate space?
Well, obviously, yes. I am more hopeful now than I've ever been about our future in space. And that includes the time when I was, this naive kid back in the late 70s when, we were building a space shuttle and we thought that was going to open up space.
Yeah. And we've just been piddling around in Earth orbit, low Earth orbit, ever since, basically.
And the reason for that is that, we had the space shuttle, the National Space Transportation System. That was the official name of it, the National Space Transportation System.
And competition,
And we continued this tradition of all our hero astronauts. Every year they would come up with a new astronaut selection process, and you have this class, and they would all be, obviously they're not, because there's, a lot more of them, and in fact there's more of them than are ever going to fly, given the current plans. So it's not like it was back in the 60s when they had, the Mercury 7, and Life magazine did a hagiography on them and, airbrushed out all the bad parts, which was part of the fascism, and, that's one of the cases you would make for it. But NASA is still living in the 1960s. And it can't.
Well, I wonder I got a devil's advocate this one just a smidge here, okay? Because once you make the life coverage of the Mercury astronauts fascist propaganda, I'm like, wow, man, come on, you're bringing me down here with your your critique. I understand the broad. That program didn't get us to where we want it to be,
But that's because you think that fascist is a bad word. Every time I say that X is fascist, I always prepend it with
not that there's anything wrong with that. Oh, okay, all right.
Whole point of Jonah's book. It's that Wilson was a fascist. Franklin Roosevelt was a fascist. If you objectively look at what the program was, these people, it's fascism. Nazis. That's the whole point. Is that Hitler gave fascism a bad name? Okay. I mean, I say that, you know, jokingly, but I'm serious. That, you know, Hitler was a leftist. Mussolini
right.
was a leftist. But they were denounced by the left because they turned against, you know, they turned against Joe Stalin, who they loved.
So if we're saying that the here's my sticking point, okay? I now I can't tell if you're critiquing it or not when you use the word fascist, because you're saying not that that's a bad thing, but I have to say that even if you want to label that fascism, I would still say that there was something heroic about those guys. And,
well, of course, but there was something heroic about Yuri Gagarin too. Does that make communism good?
No, it does not. It does not. But I do view Gagarin as a hero. And in fact, we talked about him in exactly those terms on this program a few weeks ago when we were talking about his first flight into space. But let's leave the question aside as to whether it's fascist or I'll grant that it is, and not that that's a bad thing. How would you have liked to have seen it unfold? How could it have unfolded better, do you think? And could we have been on the moon sooner? I mean, I guess without the Cold War impetus, right? Would we ever have had a big serious space program? I guess that's the real question.
Well, that is a very, very interesting question, because everything that happened from basically 1947 on, you know, was driven by the Cold War. But even there were alternate paths. I mean, there was an alternate path. People, you know, the Air Force was figuring out how to get into space, and they had an X-15 program that was trying to figure out how to do that.
Right.
And that could have evolved farther, and some of that technology could have spun off into the private sector, and people could have been doing the same things they're doing now in terms of giving rides into space, you know, maybe in the 70s, based on that technology, had it continued to be evolved. The real problem was, up until 1958, there was this agency, it wasn't really even an agency, it was an advisory committee, the National Advisory Committee on Aeronautics, that had really nurtured and driven the aviation industry.
Right.
And they did it by developing technology, by going out and talking. It saw industry, commercial industry, as its customer, not just commercial industry. They also talked to the Air Force, obviously, and or before that the Army, Air Corps, or whatever. But they saw their role as developing technology to support both, you know, military and commercial uses. But when NASA was formed, that agency or that advisory committee got sucked in, subsumed into this new operational government agency that had a charter to put people into space, and, you know, 3 years later, in 1961, send a man to the moon and bring him back. And it became an operational agency that was going to develop and operate its own vehicles, you know, to accomplish all the nation's goals in space. And from that point on, we got way off the track, because that is not America. That is not how we traditionally did things in this country. It was an anomaly because of the Cold War. And I don't know what the alternate path would have been, but I would like to think that had NACA continued, it might have became NACAA, you know, Aviation and Astronautics, and continued to serve that role as the astronautical industry developed.
Much like maybe the FAA, but for space.
Well, no. That's a different thing. FAA is a regulatory agency.
Right.
NACA was a technology development organization. The closest thing to it right now is DARPA.
Okay, sort of a blue sky.
Yeah, you know, let's fund those high risk technologies that nobody else is looking at. Nobody else, you know, private, you know, companies are not going to spend their money to develop. But NASA has gotten completely out of that business. They shut down NIAC. I can't remember what that acronym is for, but it was a National Institution for Advanced Concepts, something like that. They have shut it down because they have pulled money out of everything else to put it into developing this new launch vehicle that's probably never going to fly because it has so fundamentally flawed in its concept. But that's where they are. They have decided, you know, Mike Griffin has decided NASA's going to go back to becoming its own customer completely, you know, with a small exception. You know, he'll throw like a few percent, a couple percent of the money at COTS, the Commercial Orbital Transportation System project, which is supposed to be private. But I mean, the vast majority of funds, it's just scrambling to try to pour everything it has to into rescuing this disastrous architecture that they've taken on.
This new vehicle, I mean, is it going to be powered by something very similar to the Saturn V? I mean, is it
This new vehicle is taking a shuttle SRB as a first stage, except it's not a shuttle SRB because they have to add an extra segment to it. So it's a 5-segment SRB, which has never been flown. And then they discover that, this thing, when it gets close to burnout, is going to be like a big organ pipe, you know, in terms of resonant frequencies, and it's going to be vibrating a lot, and we have to figure out some way to mitigate that so it doesn't shake the upper stage and the crew apart. And now they're talking about things like, as a way to mitigate it, we have to put in a little ring of rocket motors that fire backwards, you know, offsetting the thrust, firing up at the same frequency that it's going to vibrate at. It's kind of like a, you know, giant version of a Bose noise canceling headphone. I mean, this is what they're reduced to, because they decided, without any really good, as far as I can tell, preliminary analysis, just to shift over from this concept and just ignore everything that everybody had told him before Mike Griffin came in, because this is what he wanted to do. This is the danger of bringing in a rocket scientist as the administrator of NASA, because he thought he was smarter than everybody else, and he knew what he wanted to do.
Well, it's the old saying about if
running NASA ain't rocket science.
Everything looks like a nail. If you're a rocket scientist, right? Every problem looks like one you can solve with a bigger and better rocket, right?
Well, the thing is that, you know, the best, I think most historians would tell you, the most effective NASA administrator that ever existed was Jim Webb, who was not the first, but like the second NASA administrator, who was the one who basically set up Apollo, and he was a lawyer. But the important thing was that he had good connections to the White House, and he understood politically what had to happen and what couldn't happen, and he was very effective in making things happen, and he got us to the moon. But the point is, because getting to the moon by the end of the decade was politically important. Since then, nothing NASA has ever done has been politically important.
I just want to note that we had a comment in the chat room. He was a lawyer, not that there's anything wrong with that.
that's right. I agree.
So I think we want to stay pure on that, and we never hold that against you either, Stephen.
Thank you.
In fact, let that be an inspiration to you.
That's right. I mean, Jim Webb was he was one of the early administrators, and he was the best in terms of NASA accomplishing its goal. Yeah, I mean, but the point was that NASA had a goal. It was politically important, and they had 4% of the federal budget.
Right.
And now they got like a little over 0.5%, with very little prospects for getting more, because what they're doing is not politically important.
So I guess the question is, for NASA to carry on in its the direction it wants to go in and be the kind of agency it wants to be, is could the development of space become politically important again, such that we could fund the kinds of programs they've done before? Or alternatively, do we just look for a different model of getting there, one that's more like the let's do the XPRIZE on steroids, right, rather than
right.
Apollo on steroids.
Right. It's clearly the latter. I mean, I don't see, you know, short of, unless Phoenix takes a picture of Marvin with the you know, or whatever the thing that causes the Earth to go up in an earth-shattering kaboom.
Yeah. Space modulator.
Space modulator. Right?
Yeah.
It was the Illudium Q36. Or
whatever. Yeah, there you go. You got
I don't
it.
Remember what the exactly what it was. But, you know, if Phoenix sees Marvin, you know, with the Illudium Q36, okay, then all bets are off the table. Then all of a sudden it becomes important again. But right now it is not important. And I don't see how you make it important.
There's an interesting paradox about finding life on Mars. I'm going to get to that in just a moment. But first, I've got to say that this is Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. We're talking with Rand Simberg about fascism and Mars and lots of other interesting topics. If you'd like to join us, you can join us in our chat room, or we're going to keep the phone lines open for a few more minutes. You can call us at 347-215-8972. So here's the paradox about finding life on Mars. If we found Marvin there, you're right. There would suddenly then be a huge influx of funding and interest in programs, et cetera. But that would then mean Mars is actually off limits to us in terms of being an ultimate like destination for humanity.
That's a different issue. I mean, no, if we found Marvin there with his Illudium Q36 space modulator, that would you know, set off a whole lot of funding toward one part of the federal government. On the other hand, if we found some microbes up there, that would set off. Then now we're dealing with, okay, now we got to quarantine the place.
Right, right. Okay, well, say anything from microbes up through ET, right, but not Mars.
Well, no, but,
you're right,
but there's
a difference. Issue.
I mean, in one case it's a defense issue, in the other case it's a science issue.
Sure, okay.
It's a science and environment and, you know, protecting the planet Mars and, you know, whatever.
So since it's probably somewhat more likely that if we find anything, it's going to be more like the microbes.
Yes,
it seems more likely.
Yeah, it seems
yeah.
more likely.
I guess the question is, what's, you know, when are we safe to start making plans to go to Mars, or is that even a good plan? Is it a good idea for us to think in terms of let's establish a presence on Mars, or should we be, you know?
There's nothing wrong with thinking about establishing a presence on Mars. What's wrong is saying, okay, we have to build this vehicle, you know, we have to establish a 5 and 10 and 15 year plan to do it. That's what's wrong. Because we cannot predict what the course of either technology or space business is going to be over the next 20 years. And the fundamental problem of space and doing stuff in space that has existed since the beginning of the program remains, and NASA has thrown up its hands and said, we give up, we don't care, is that it costs too much to get there.
Right.
They are doing nothing, absolutely nothing, to reduce the cost of getting into space. All they're doing is figuring out, okay, we're not going to fly a space shuttle anymore, so how do we get people into space? And not only that, but how do we get people into space using a NASA launch vehicle?
Right.
And not buying it from the private sector.
So if...
But once... I used to have a SIG on my Usenet post that said, you know, it is not NASA's job to send a man to Mars. It is NASA's job to make it possible for the Planetary Society or for the, you know, National Geographic Society to send a man to Mars.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
And again, that's functioning like in a DARPA-type capacity they would be.
Sort of. Not just DARPA. It's more like the thing that, you know, I don't have to spare, but I pulled my hair when Mike Griffin said that his architecture was the interstate highway system to space. I mean, what a joke. I mean, yeah, right. If the interstate highway system, if we'd built an interstate highway system such that you could drive somebody, you could drive a car across the country and back twice a year with four people in it, yeah, I guess it would be the interstate highway system to space. But that's not the IHS I know.
Right, and doesn't the analogy break down? It's kind of like if we had started building the interstate highway system back in the, I don't know, teens, right? The 1820s or
something
like that.
Well, which we did with canals.
Okay. But I mean, in terms of like opening up the frontier, opening up the West, we didn't go in there and lay down 4-lane highways. We sent a few people out, and then we laid down infrastructure, and then more people came, et cetera. Right. That's the
well, right. And the point is, we didn't build a national, a transcontinental transportation vehicle, that could carry four people back and forth a couple times a year for a few billion dollars per trip.
Well, the analogy is the reason it's there's a steep curve, I guess, to getting to space. I mean, let's say it's 1800, and I'm sitting in Boston, and I'm sick of Boston, and I decide to go west. If I wanted to, I could just start walking west,
right?
And eventually, I'd make California if I didn't get attacked by Indians or whatever. I mean, at some point, I'd
run
reach,
out of water.
Lots of
obstacles there.
Yeah, I'd have obstacles, but it'd be technically possible. In theory, I could make California. But, here I am sitting in 2008, and I really, really want to go to the moon. Well,
I can't walk to orbit.
Yeah, I just can't get there.
Yeah.
I got to catch a ride with somebody.
But you're not going to catch it with NASA.
Yeah.
You're not going to catch it with NASA with their current plans.
That's right. That's right.
So we wrote a little bit about this Jim McClain's idea to kickstart Martian settlement of Mars with a one-man, one-way mission to Mars. What do you think of that idea?
Well, it's intriguing. It's not going. No government's going to do it,
right?
what more do you want me to say? I mean, yeah, I can imagine. Again, it gets back to my point: the National Geographic Society.
Right.
I mean, they're if NASA were building the infrastructure and reducing the cost of getting to orbit, then yeah, somebody could do that. Some private organization could do that, or even an individual. The guy who wanted to jump from the balloon a couple of weeks ago from Canada. He could do that instead.
Yeah.
People who climbed Everest could do that instead.
That one of the ideas that was proposed right after Gagarin's flight, when we decided we were going to the moon, and it was understood that there was a large technological hurdles that would have to be leaped, that they talked about doing that,
sending
a one-way, one-man mission to the moon.
That's right, because that was they were scrambling for ideas. They were because it was important to get to the moon, not because anybody gave a shit about the moon. Pardon my French, but because it was important to beat the Russians again. Nothing that happened in the 60s in space had anything to do with space, other than it was the high ground. It was seen as the high ground. People were concerned that the Russians would have bombs orbiting over us, and they could drop them down on us any time and whatever. And all this was like technological nonsense, but it was space was new. People didn't understand. People were very worried.
Right.
You said, Johnson said, we're not going to go sleep by the light of a Russian moon or a communist moon. There was nothing about Apollo that was about getting humanity into space. Absolutely nothing. And that was the fundamental flaw. And that remains a fundamental flaw because we have never had that national conversation that said, why are we doing this space stuff? Why are we spending 1%, 0.5%, whatever we're spending of the national budget, because it shrinks every year because all the non-discretionary stuff grows, and NASA is always discretionary, it's part of that. But why are we doing this? And we have never said, nobody has ever forcefully, said, we have to settle space. We have to expand into space. We have to have people living off planet. Even with Bush's VSE, he did not say that. He did say, he sort of said it, he sort of hinted at it, but in a way that was deniable when he said, humanity is going out into the cosmos, which to me was like the most the only, I shouldn't say only, but the most, you know, thrilling part of that speech. It was a new thing in space policy, in national policy, to say humanity is going out into the cosmos.
Right.
But the implementation, the follow-through, everything has been a disaster after that, because if we follow this plan, humanity is not going out into the cosmos. At best, you know, a few astronauts a year will go out to the moon, you know, a decade from now, if we're lucky. And then the program will die because it's going to be so ridiculously expensive.
So what do you think can turn it around? What are some of the more positive possible developments going forward?
The positive developments are people are putting their own money into this for their own reasons. I mean, that's positive development. I mean, that's the whole, it's kind of like healthcare. You know, the problem with healthcare is that the people that are paying for it are completely disconnected from the people, you know, who are providing the service. And you know, again, this is the same case with space. The people who are paying for it are completely disconnected from what's actually happening in space. But when it starts happening privately, now all of a sudden people are saying, I'm going to put my money into this company that's actually going to do this thing in space. It's not... You don't have this big intermediary with Congress and K Street and the congressional delegation from, you know, northern Alabama and Houston and the Cape, you know, which completely obliterates any interest that anybody has at a grassroots level, you know, because that's really what it comes down to. What's happening is now that people are want to do things in space with their own money. They're putting their own money down, and it's actually happening. There are companies forming to satisfy their desires.
Yeah. It makes me wonder, you know, will the day come when, you know, the private sector leapfrogs NASA, and then NASA says, well, you know, last one out, you know, make sure to turn out the light, because we might, you know, the private sector has surpassed us. They made it to Mars first or whatever.
Well, yeah. NASA will never say that.
Yeah.
I mean, Congress will say that.
Yeah, I guess, yeah, the person holding the purse strings, which...
Yeah, NASA's not going to say that.
Yeah.
Jerry Pournelle calls that the iron law of
what they're doing, you know, till their budgets get wiped out.
Right. No bureaucracy is going to shut itself down. Somebody else has to do that.
That does not happen.
Right. So I'm just going to have to wrap this up. I just looked at the clock and realized we're very near our time. Stephen, you got your question in. Michael, anything from the chat room? We just checked in with you guys briefly. Were there any questions or comments from the chat room that we wanted to share before we have to say goodbye to our guest?
I would say we got into a little tangent with no effective answer about if there's existential pressure on us here on Earth, is that going to be enough to motivate space exploration and a renewed interest in getting to space? And we concluded that it's unlikely.
Oh, the old When Worlds Collide scenario, right? We build the space ark to escape from the...
Yeah, well, I mean, I think there would be, if Apophis really was going to hit us in 15 years,
right,
or whenever, I don't know what the schedule is, but I mean, just hypothetically, whatever, pick whatever asteroid name you want, that would get people's attention, and then it might become important. But short of that, I don't see it.
Yeah, it seems like that's almost too high of a price to pay, too, right? It's like, oh, okay, I know one thing I get us out into space is if the world ended, but maybe we can...
If the world is about to end, and if we actually put the resources in to become a space, and we say the only way to fix this is to actually develop these spacefaring capabilities, I mean, that would be a way. I don't think it's likely. I think the more likely path is that, you know, there's a lot of people on this planet that want to do stuff in space, and they're getting kind of tired. They're not going to wait for NASA anymore because they got a lot of money. You know, Jeff Bezos has a lot of money.
Right.
Elon Musk has a lot of money.
And it turns out that what they have is sufficient to.
We've got a crossover. You know, you can kind of draw a graph in your mind of the technical capability and the money, and they're crossing over right now, and that's why the money now is finally starting to flow into these private ventures that are actually going to reduce the cost of access to space, which has never been a high priority for the government because didn't have to be cheap for the government to do it. If it was important, they would do it, even if it was expensive. And you know, there was no motivation for them to actually reduce the costs.
Right. So you look to these kind of private pioneers opening up space in a new way. And I guess Google is kind of doing that too, right? With their
really. I just think that's a marketing gimmick.
Oh well.
I'm sorry.
Worked on me.
I'm not an enthusiast for the Google X Prize. I just don't see how it's going to do much of anything.
But the point being that private money finding its way towards private development and exploitation of space. Well, I think we're going to have to leave it there because we're right at our time. Rand, we thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us this evening.
Well, thanks for putting up with me.
And we look forward to following more of your comments on multiple topics over at Transterrestrial Musings, and hope to have you back on Fast Forward Radio again very soon.
Okay. Well, look forward to that, too.
Thank you. Okay, Stephen, what do we got going on to send us home this evening?
Well, we got the Alice Project's song is The Third Day. We heard from this band last with the song Regifting for the Holidays.
I was about to say that band's name is familiar. So they gave us the Regifting for the Holidays, and now this song is
The Third Day.
Third Day. Okay. Any hints as to what that's about? No.
Not really. I'm just gonna roll it. But anyway, it's been fun talking with you and Rand tonight and Michael, and we'll see the audience back here same time next week.
All right, enjoyed it very much. Thanks, Stephen. We'll have complete show notes as always when we get them up there. Thanks to everyone in the chat room who participated. Thank you, Michael, and thanks to all who listened. We look forward to being with you all again on the next Fast Forward Radio. Good night.
Ciao.
You wanted more. You closed the door. Never thought you'd see. Trying to get back inside with me.